Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, join us as we explore the issues and ideas shaping our world with today's key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started, sharp, relevant, and right to the heart of the story. Coming up on the program, what will the US's planned $8 billion arms sale to Israel mean for the conflict, the ongoing conflict in the Middle East? We'll find out what's on the cards for the retail credit industry in the coming year. Are illegal miners entitled to food supply, or does blocking this infringe human rights? A controversial debate currently raging among the legal fraternity, human rights groups and mining companies. And why zero emissions transport will be among the key trends for 2025. It's Wednesday, the 8th of January. Let's start with a focus on the escalating violence in Gaza, where recent Israeli airstrikes have killed 14 people amidst intense efforts by mediators to broker a truce. At the same time, the United States announcing an $8 billion US arms deal with Israel, and that is raising questions about its role in the ongoing conflict. I'm in conversation now with Zinat Adam, Deputy Executive Director at the Afro-Middle East Center, a leading think tank specializing in Middle Eastern affairs. Zinat, a very warm welcome to you. So the significance, firstly, of this arms deal between the United States and Israel in the context of this conflict. What is your assessment? How are you reading it?
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me on air, and good afternoon. I think that this is really indicative of the American policy being very closely aligned to Israel and supporting a genocide that's been taking place. If we look at the figures and the numbers, since October 2023, the military aid from the US has increased dramatically to Israel in the amount of $22 billion of military aid in just the 15 months. That is looking at about 78% reliance by Israel on US imports. So the $8 billion within that context is really a pittance, but it also is indicative of a long-term strategy of the Americans continuing to support Israel in its expansionist policy in the Middle East.
And this is a strategy that is likely to continue, perhaps even increase, with the new Trump administration.
Likely to increase. However, we do know that Trump has some reservations about his dealings with Netanyahu. In his previous administration, he had expressed frustration with Netanyahu, saying things that Netanyahu has drawn the U.S. into endless wars in the region. So perhaps there may be different strategies. But ultimately, if we look at the policies both of the Democrats and the Republicans, there's not very much of a drastic difference in terms of their approach to Israel, especially since they have such a strong Israeli lobby in the form of AIPAC in the United States, and a very strong military industrial complex. So the idea of being able to sell these arms to Israel will not necessarily be contested within the Senate and in Congress.
Let's move to current mediation efforts now in trying to de-escalate the violence. To what extent is this working, and the role, for instance, that regional players like Egypt and Qatar are playing in these attempts? Is this amounting to anything at all?
We're hopeful. The Trump administration has issued some sort of an ultimatum saying that if the hostages are not returned by the 20th, when Trump comes into office, there will be all hell to pay. But I think that's just conjecture and trying to apply some kind of pressure on the negotiation teams. The mediators, if we remember just a few months ago, Qatar froze their role as a mediator, expressing frustration with a lack of seriousness and good faith on both sides, from the Israelis and from Hamas. But they've resumed their role of mediation and seem to be holding their cards very close to their hearts, not wanting to express too much on the technicalities of that negotiation. We know that there were very senior CIA and Mossad heads who have met in Doha this week, and they seems to be progress in terms of the technical discussions around that negotiation. But we haven't seen much momentum since November 2023, when the deal resulted in 109 hostages being exchanged for 250 Palestinian prisoners. There is hope, but still to be seen whether that would result in anything meaningful.
Talking of momentum, are we seeing any change or any shift in global public opinion as far as this conflict is concerned? And if so, might that alter the paradigm or the trajectory of diplomatic efforts?
There still is a lot of public opinion wanting an end to a genocide, considering the staggering numbers and the kind of horrific pictures that we're watching. Whilst the numbers in terms of the casualties is at 45,000, that has been at 45,000 for a number of months, because there just isn't any means of quantifying how many dead people there are. Lancet, the medical think reports have issued that a few months ago that there may be 120,000 people, but that's likely to have risen even since then. So when we're looking at this week, seven frozen babies, hospitals obliterated, people burned alive in their tents, you cannot, as human beings, continue to watch this without wanting a change. And then from human rights organizations such as Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and others have come out very strongly calling for an immediate and implementable long-term ceasefire, not just something that's going to be a two-week pause. But there seems to also have been some empathy fatigue around the world, and people have stopped looking at what's going on in Gaza, almost as if it is a forgotten strip that has just been destructed. And this is really where it concerns those of us who are watching this, that there needs to be more momentum pushed in at levels of the United Nations, and certainly at the level of these negotiations taking place in Doha.
It was also interesting to read a couple of days ago that Iran's foreign minister is warning, and I quote, of a large-scale war if Israel attacks again. Again, this is disturbing, and it also is a signifier, perhaps, that unless some kind of truce is brought to bear, this is or has the potential to spread more regionally with devastating consequences.
We're already looking at a regional war, and we witnessed that just a few weeks ago as developments happened in Syria. Israel expanded its operations across the border beyond the Golan Heights, which had already occupied, but going further into Syrian territory. And that's concerning, because there shouldn't be any violation of sovereignty and territorial integrity of any of the countries around there. But there has been an escalation across various fronts, including with the Yemenis, including with Lebanon, including now with Syria. We know that Iran has also been engaged in this. We have seen a significantly weakened Iran over the last couple of months, and their capacity or ability to respond seems to have depleted quite a bit. But we're still looking at high risks of an escalation and regional turmoil.
Thank you very much indeed, Zinat Adam, Deputy Executive Director at the Afro Middle East Center.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
I want to reflect now on some of the lessons of 2024 and look ahead to this year for the retail credit market in South Africa. And I'm in conversation with Regan Adams, who's Chief Executive Officer at RCS, a leader in flexible and innovative credit solutions. Regan, I'm hoping, is going to share some insight on balancing credit growth on the one hand with responsible lending, the rise of digital transformation, and how the broader industry can adapt to evolving consumer needs. So, Regan, a very warm welcome, and maybe let's start off with some of the more significant difficulties or hurdles that the retail credit market faced last year.
Thanks, Jamie, and very happy to be with you guys. Look, it was a tough year. I think it was a tough year macroeconomically speaking. But, you know, this has already started towards the back end of 22, carrying on in 2023, where we've seen rising interest rates, rising inflation. And of course, all of us have exposure to inflation, so we're all impacted by the cost of living. But I think the interest rates increasing have really impacted, especially the leveraged middle to high income segments, quite significantly. And you get to a position where your debt repayments are significantly more than what your cost of income or your income gets adjusted on an annual basis. So we've seen a lot of consumers out there really battling to repay their debt as a result of these factors. And as I said, it started towards the back end in 22, carried on 23, and in 24 was no different. We saw that becoming more problematic. And, you know, we've seen some difficult signs in the first 6 months of 24. We saw increase in debt review applications. We saw higher defaults on secured debt like mortgages. And that all points to stress in the market from a repayment perspective. So I think it's been very tough on the consumers. From a trading perspective, you can really see on the retail side that trading has been quite muted. Credit trading has been quite muted. Cash definitely has outstripped credit trading when you look at the retailers. So all in all, I think it's been a challenging 6 to 9 months in 2024 for the consumers out there.
Regan, interestingly, and we did cover this earlier on the program, this concept or this notion of buy now, pay later, it's a trend that is particularly influencing younger consumers and how it compares to traditional lay-by systems. What is it? And explain to me why you think that is finding some favor.
You know, Jeremy, the buy now, pay later products came kind of into being just as we came out of COVID. And as you know, credit in particular took quite a big knock in COVID because, you know, people were losing their jobs or they weren't earning the income that they used to earn. And for lenders, it was difficult to assess consumers for credit because all the models that you had to assess someone was kind of turned upside down with the pandemic. And, you know, through credit regulation, maybe we'll talk about it a little bit later, we need to do affordability assessments, we need to do income assessments, you need to do quite rigorous credit assessments through the bureaus. And this takes time, and it's a process that's very robust, but also time-consuming, and there is some friction in that process. Now, buy now, pay later, where it's a very, very simple process. It's not regulated in South Africa. It is for the consumer, you don't pay any fees, you don't pay any interest. So from a pure consumer perspective, it's easy to get these products. They're typically over 3 month repayment period. It's smaller ticket sizes. And it's easier to, the approval rates on buy now, pay later products are way superior than credit products because it is, it doesn't need to apply through all these credit regulation that's there. And, you know, the younger consumers, they like this because, you know, credit is seen as kind of the older generation's thing. You know, the old cards, store cards and so on. And this is a mechanism that is mainly digital. It's kind of very appeals very much to a younger segment. And relative to lay-bys, why retailers like it is, you know, with lay-bys, you still need to hold on to the goods for 3 months before it gets released to the consumer. And that means holding on stock, and there's a stock holding cost. But buy now, pay later, obviously, you can take the stock on day one, and it's repaid over a period of over the 3 months by consumers.
You also talk about the concept of extending credit to something called thin file consumers. And all of this is driven by machine learning, which enables that but manages the risk at the same time. Is more of the space that you're operating in going to be impacted then by artificial intelligence when it comes to decision making?
Yes, yeah, I would say just not just as decision making also, but also just generally how one does business. You know, the specific aspect of artificial intelligence that we use in terms of our credit decisioning is machine learning models. And the benefit of machine learning models is that you can put quite a lot of variables and data in machine learning, and the machine learning models can crunch these data much more sophisticatedly and more granularly. So you're able to differentiate risk better. You're able to look at a lot more variables to assess people for credit and in a much more scientific way. So that is really beneficial, and it means that you can consume large data sets to be able to make those decisions. Now, in this particular case, when you reference thin file is a term that is given to individuals that don't necessarily have a credit bureau record on the bureaus. And what you then do is you use other data to be able to assess that person's credit worthiness. And this is really where we've used machine learning models to take some of these other data sources and assess somebody for credit.
And just a final one then, let's look ahead to the rest of this year. Interest rate cuts, hopefully, inflation, the picture is starting to look a little bit better. What impact is all of this going to have on the credit market? You outlined at the beginning how tough it's been since end 2022-23. Yeah. A glimmer of hope here, perhaps?
Definitely, Jeremy. I would see that lenders will be a bit more expansive in their credit appetite, their risk appetite. We've already seen towards the back end of last year that lenders are beginning to open up. You know, right through the year, there's been demand for credit. Obviously, people are still searching for credit, and lenders have been more conservative. But we're definitely seeing, and that includes us as a lender, we're definitely seeing more opening up, being a bit more expansive in terms of taking on more credit. And like you say, the 50 basis points decrease was welcome towards the end of last year. We believe there should be further cuts. Inflation's kind of moderating within that range, which is really good. So I definitely see from a consumer perspective, I would expect there to be more availability of credit, which should bode well for the lending space, but also for the retail market out there.
I have absolutely no doubt that we will talk again in 2025. Regan Adams, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer of RCS.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, a shocking and deeply disturbing story emerging from Stilfontein, west of Johannesburg, where rescued illegal miners have revealed harrowing details of survival, including claims of being forced to eat human flesh and also cockroaches. The story was broken by journalist Diane Hawker, and she joins me now to shed some light on the grim realities of illegal mining and, I guess, the desperation faced by many of those involved. Diane, welcome. I've used the descriptor harrowing. Maybe just walk me through how these shocking revelations came to light. We know that these miners had been underground for some time.
I think harrowing is the right word, Jeremy, because I think we haven't had as much information about what's going on underground as this latest affidavit has revealed. So the genesis of that affidavit is that the Constitutional Court has been approached by an organization called MAKUA, which is the Mining Affected Communities United in Action. And that organization has previously gone to the High Court with various applications. But in this application, they were able to submit affidavits from miners. And they are saying that the Constitutional Court needs to intervene as the highest court in South Africa, partly due to how bad the situation has gotten. Now, one of the affidavits from the miners by someone by the name of Mueletsi, that affidavit details quite a harrowing story of how he was able to survive underground. And that miner mentions the eating of cockroaches. He mentions drinking the underground water, which is essentially poisoned water. And he also speaks about the effects that drinking that water had on him, feeling lightheaded, feeling unwell, and experiencing severe cramping. But it was part of the only way to survive. And then he mentions that when he was in hospital, he was able to speak to two other miners who then informed him about those who were left behind eating human flesh. Now, those two other miners have also deposed to very short affidavits confirming that, essentially putting it on the record that illegal miners or artisanal miners underground are eating human flesh. And it does speak to how desperate the situation appears to have gotten underground, if the miners have exhorted to that level and having to be that desperate, because there really isn't anything else for them to consume underground.
The miners also speaking, Diane, about coercion and violence. Through the work that you've done on this story, how widespread is this exploitation within the illegal mining sector? It would appear that it's getting a lot worse.
I think that the illegal mining sector as a whole has gotten quite bad over time. You know, we've been speaking about illegal mining as South Africans for a number of years. And as more and more mines have closed, more and more people have gone underground illegally to try and extract what remains of the gold there. We've heard a lot also about syndicates running these operations and there being kind of bosses underground who are controlling the situation. And I think perhaps there is an opportunity that now that these issues have come to light for the South African government to really do a deep dive and further investigate what's really going on underground in a more comprehensive way, because we are getting these bits and pieces of information. And it does seem like there's quite a lot of organization within the sector. There's quite a lot of different stakeholders. If you think about those bringing the food to the miners before the operation, the police operation began, if you think about those buying the gold, there is an element of it being quite an organized crime operation that really needs to be dealt with in a more comprehensive way.
And that's going to be difficult, because one's got to ask the question about whether appetite for intervention actually exists, because all of this highlights gaps, doesn't it, in our approach to regulating mining and combating these illegal operations.
Major gaps, Jeremy. I mean, if you look at that area where the Stilfontein mine is, I spent some time there late last year, and there are a number of mine shafts that are just open, uncovered, and apart from illegal mining, they are actually hazardous to people who could be walking in that area. There's no fencing. There's no way to stop children, for example, falling into those shafts. And essentially, many of the shafts in that area have been left unattended and uncovered by mining operations who have left. And it's not only a problem that we see in Stilfontein, but in other areas where illegal mining operations have taken foot. So there's definitely a need for, you know, the government to enforce certain elements where the companies can also do what they are supposed to do and ensure that the mines are decommissioned in a proper systematic way that would ensure that illegal miners don't go in there, but also to ensure that there's safety for the communities around there.
And what sort of response from the formal mining sector? One gets the sense that the silence has been deafening.
The silence has been deafening, but in this case, in the Constitutional Court case, the company that actually owns the mine has also been cited as a respondent. And they've asked for a bit more time to submit court papers. They've asked for time until the 15th of January. So hopefully, the Buffelsfontein mine, a gold mine company, will officially come with some sort of information as to how this situation arose. We know that they are the ones that actually contracted the mine rescue services company to start doing the surveying and to figure out how much it will cost to remove those miners. The cost has been put at 11.3 million rand. But beyond that, there isn't much information coming from them at this stage. But this case does offer them an opportunity to put on the record what their view is and what their interventions might be going forward.
And just finally, for the miners themselves who have been rescued, it's going to be difficult because they now have to face a degree of reintegration, but they are still facing potential criminal charges, are they not?
They are indeed facing criminal charges. Those who have come out have been arrested. Some who are, you know, immigrants or migrants will be deported, and those who are South Africans are most likely to face charges internally. But interestingly, Jeremy, when I was in Stilfontein, I spoke to one of the miners who had come out, and he said in no uncertain terms that if the police leave, he's definitely going underground. And that does speak to a level of desperation in that area, because so many of the mines have closed down. There aren't many other opportunities. And when you speak to the residents around there, there's an area called Kuma. Those residents rely heavily on the illegal miners. And residents that I spoke to there also indicated that they have no issue with the legal miners, because illegal miners bring in a lot of money into that area. So I'm not so sure about reintegration, but it does seem like some of those miners would definitely pick up their tools again and head back underground if the police operation does end and they're not spending time in jail.
Diane Hawker, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So let's take another look now at trends that are set to define 2025 and challenges and opportunities they bring for South Africa. And I want to focus specifically on transport now. And I'm going to talk to Justin Kutsier, Chief Executive Officer of Go Metro. It's a leader in transport solutions. And Justin, I'm hoping, is going to help us look at the future of zero emissions transport and its implications for South Africa. Justin, a very warm welcome and a happy new year to you. The momentum behind vehicle electrification in South Africa, the sense I'm getting is that it's starting to plateau. Is that the case? And if so, what factors specifically would be contributing to this?
So as we look going into 2025, electrification is actually heading in completely the other direction. It's set for a huge boost over the next 2 to 3 years as Chinese models start hitting our shores. And these Chinese models have much more superior range. They really have class finishes, and they're going to be very keen to enter markets because they're going to face tariffs in Europe and the US. So Chinese models are going to be very keen to enter the South African market. So interest has plateaued from legacy car makers in that they have not been able to produce compelling models, both range-wise, finish-wise, and just price points. But I do believe that the brands that we'll be buying in the next few years, we may not even have heard of yet, like XPeng, NIO, BYD. These are all emerging Chinese brands that will be hitting our shores in the coming years.
How much of a mindset change is this going to be for South African consumers to get their head around a change between electrification and the internal combustion engine? Surely that's the biggest risk lying that lies ahead for this market.
Yeah, so it's actually a much simpler product to live with. You only have 8 moving parts rather than 1,000 or 2,000 that your internal combustion engine has. You are obviously limited with range, so there are applications that you can do and applications that you can't do. But just like you've got a city runaround and a family vehicle, you're likely to have a electric runaround for your daily commute. And then a family car for longer trips or longer travels that is still an ICE engine. And so I think consumer behaviors will follow price points that make sense. And that's the key thing for us, is to bring vehicle sticker prices, electric vehicle sticker prices down in the South African market, because it is still prone to both a import tax and an ad valorem tax. So any electric vehicle that's imported into South Africa, you're paying about 42% of that to duties. So I do think that the most important imperative in 2025 is for the duties to be looked at by government, and for incentives to be placed for us to lower sticker prices. Once those sticker prices are lowered, the running cost is half that of an ICE vehicle, the maintenance is much lower, and you'll soon find charging strategies and charging habits that make sense. And so I do think that consumer adoption will go very quickly.
And all of that does make perfect sense to me. The question, of course, is whether government has the appetite to relax the restrictions that you have that you've alluded to.
Yeah, so they have implemented, and the president signed into law a few days ago, a incentive for electric vehicle factories to receive 150% tax rebates for any equipment purchased between 2026 and 2036. And so government does want EVs to be built in South Africa. We are also in helping a number of brands and OEMs to look at the South African market and to look at setting up manufacturing in South Africa. And so I think there is a unique opportunity for our automotive legacy and our automotive manufacturing hubs to have electric factories in the next 2 to 3 years and for our domestic market to be fed. The product must make sense, the pricing must make sense, and the policy must make sense. So there is a lot of moving parts that must work. But I do know that government is very well aware that the world is moving in this direction, and we have to start heading in that direction too.
What type of pricing ultimately are we going to be looking at, do you think?
So right now, electric vehicles already can compete on sticker price with a sedan, a van, up to a small truck. The duties are the piece that takes it over the edge. The battery efficiencies as well, if you look at battery efficiencies, they are at least 30% more efficient than they were 3 years ago. And we can expect in 2 to 3 years' time batteries to be cheaper and more efficient, more energy dense than they are today. So ranges are getting better. The longer the range, the more efficient the battery, the smaller the cost of the battery. And so electric vehicle prices, I think, are going to only get better and be more compelling on every level, sticker price, running cost, maintenance, than ICE vehicles.
You talk about Chinese market domination. What, though, about the original brands or marks? Are they just going to fold their tent up as far as this market is concerned, do you think, or is there a challenge to be mounted?
Well, right now, we haven't seen very compelling electric vehicles from legacy brands, from our existing marks. The products that are in market have very low penetration, like you point out. There is a plateau on electric vehicles, and the price points and the finishes and the technologies just aren't keeping pace. I don't know what the response is from the legacy brands, you know, what they can mount, but I do know that they are running out of time. And the products are only getting better that are coming out of China.
Let me ask you one final question, and maybe this is more at the tactility of the entire concept. But what is the drivability like of these vehicles? Is it a very different experience?
Well, it comes down to applications. So for passenger vehicles, it's a smooth ride, immediate torque, very responsive engine, very powerful motor, and very low center of gravity thanks to the battery position. So it's a very comfortable, easy, responsive drive. For commercial vehicles, it's a very stable platform to work on and to use. And the key is really the torque and the immediacy of the power makes it a very, very interesting driving experience. And then being able to brake by just lifting your foot and having regeneration, comfortable because you can essentially usually drive with one foot doing the acceleration, and the moment that you lift off, you start regenerating. So one foot driving becomes possible, and quite convenient. So it's a very, very nice driving experience. The finishes that are coming out of the new brands are phenomenal, really, really premium finishes. And the designs are, because you've got all the space and creativity, you know, the designs are a bit out there sometimes. Mm.
It'll be very interesting to see how this market plays out in the short to medium term. Justin Kutsia, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer at Go Metro, a leader in innovative transport solutions. And that's where we're going to park the program for today. We are back tomorrow with another 30 minutes of issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.